Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, for all our previous 250-plus episodes. Most recently talked about The Professional, The Nice Guys. I wrote a quick thing about Muddy Monster, and we also talked about The Verdict, and I'm Not There. Next week, we'll probably be talking, or later this week, I don't know what I'm posting this. We'll be talking about the NBA Finals next, or the NBA season in general, and then probably Kimmy Schmidt the week after. So, yeah, thanks to look forward to. And if you haven't watched Kimmy Schmidt, this is a good excuse to watch Kimmy Schmidt to keep up with our podcast, because we're burning up the charts. Anyway, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes,
James for real.
I think I'm more of the kid contact to your Connor for real.
I think that's fair. I am way funnier than you.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about pop star : Never Stop, Never Stopping.
That's right.
A movie I would see based on title alone if I knew nothing else about it.
It's a truly next level title.
But the fact that it's the first real Lonely Island movie, which we'll talk about the qualifiers for that later. And you and I are, I would say, big Lonely Island fans. Considering you got my Space Olympics reference with one line from several years ago.
I might be the person, like, I might like the Space Olympics sketch more than anybody else in the world. I, like, truly love that sketch.
No, it's fantastic. Yeah. But yes, this is one that we were looking forward to. We don't do a ton of comedies here, but...
Because I don't like to let you have your way.
Again, me being kid contact.
Yeah, fair enough.
But no, it was something, I mean... I think we were both excited just to watch it, but that doesn't mean we always want to podcast about every movie we're looking forward to seeing. Yeah. As I said, kind of some of the heavier movies kind of provide more fuel for us to talk about. But we've watched a lot of Lonely Island stuff, and we've kind of seen it be very prevalent in culture for almost 10 years now.
Yeah.
So I was happy to kind of actually talk about this a little bit seriously, because I think there's a lot there.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, so much so that we've talked about doing a Hot Rod podcast. And I mean, do you know another person that's seen Hot Rod that you didn't make watch Hot Rod?
A few.
Okay. Because I think you're the only person I know that has seen Hot Rod, other than your network that you then forced to watch it.
Oh, wow. That's a tragedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's...
Although I guess nobody's seen this movie either.
people are seeing it, I think.
Nobody I know.
Okay. And, yeah, the box office isn't great for it yet.
No, not boffo.
We'll get to that. But, yes, Hot Rod is a movie that they didn't write... Well, they did a rewrite on it. It was supposed to be Will Ferrell originally in the role is who they wanted. Andy Samberg took that role. Yorm is in it and directed by Akiva Schaffer.
That's correct.
Okay. And as I said, all three of them did a rewrite on it. And yeah, I really like that movie a lot.
It's a great movie.
it definitely has a Lonely Island feel to it, but I've heard them being interviewed about this one, and this is the one that they're really calling the first Lonely Island movie, because it was kind of their project from beginning to end. So
yeah, and it feels more like a Lonely Island movie in that, like, it's weird to say that Hot Rod has more plot involved, or like it's more of a traditional movie structure, because it's not like Hot Rod really... was a stickler for structure. You know, it's not Robert Town writing Chinatown or anything, but yeah. Compared to Popstar, it might as well be, you know, like it's pretty rigid in comparison with its plotting, but not that that's a knock on Popstar. The review I've been giving people about Popstar is I laugh my dick off, which I feel is a very Connor for real approved message.
And caught it in a box that you leave under your seat.
yeah exactly. And yeah, I mean, this movie is not really, the structure isn't the thing that brought me to the movie. It's not the thing that made me love the movie, but I did love this movie.
Did you feel it was particularly disjointed I mean, that seems yes. kind of be what you're leaning towards.
Yeah, like anytime you see like a lot of text on screen explaining what has happened in between scenes, like it's just. I mean, we talked about this Batman versus Superman, how it just felt like disjointed scenes, and that's why there were so many cuts to black. Like, Batman versus Superman could have used text titles to tell us what the fuck was happening, but they didn't, because you just can't do that in a sort of narrative movie. But in a fake documentary, it's part of the documentary style, because a lot of times when you're shooting a documentary, you just miss something. So it really works to the Lonely Island's credit here that they're able to use it. But... you know, it also makes the movie feel more like it was put together in editing, which it almost certainly was, you know, like right. there are core things that were always going to be a part of the movie. But just by the fact that, you know, you've got that shot of Akon in the opening credits, that's just not attached to anything. And if you look on the soundtrack, there's a song that Akon is on. So, you know, they shot a performance of that song that then got cut. And there's just stuff all throughout that movie, this movie, that must have been that way, you know, and the way that they sort of clean that up a lot of times is just with some text on screen.
Yeah, and keeping it short.
Exactly. They also wanted to keep it short. And this is a movie that I think really really does benefit from being short. I think if this movie's 20 minutes longer, it starts to feel kind of, even to me, you know, it would feel kind of trying.
Yeah, and I think often with a lot of comedies, they're top heavy and they start to lose their steam near the end. Mm-hmm. I think I take the front half of this movie over the back half, but there's some stuff in that second half that I really do enjoy a lot.
Yeah. I agree entirely with that.
And listening to the Lonely Island guys talk about their music as well. I mean, I think they said none of their digital shorts are over 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a gimmick and they understand. I mean, and I think it was Akiva literally said it's about as much as the audience can stand around the 3 minute mark.
Yep.
And that's just even having the way that they do the joke of these things being so grand or so epic, or putting this level of machismo into something that's so mundane, you know, Lazy Sunday, for example, you know, having these big bombastic rap characters talking about seeing the Chronicles of Narnia. Even when the joke is about overdoing it, you can't overdo that.
Yeah, exactly.
They seem to be aware that there is a ceiling for these things. And yeah, I mean, as much as I did enjoy this movie, I think your assessment is correct that putting 20 more minutes in doesn't make it 20 minutes funnier.
Exactly. Like, by accelerating the escalation of the craziness of each specific, say, song, you know, it makes the songs way funnier, because if you write a 3 minute song and condense it to 2 minutes and you are able to successfully pull that off, like, you cut some good jokes, but you only have great jokes left, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You
know? Which I think is probably their mentality. They probably write a couple more verses than that end up in the song.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, just this format in general, the kind of, I don't know, not rockumentary, I guess, popumentary, mock popumentary, just works well for them. I mean, short of doing a Lonely Island jukebox musical, you know, they get their live performances and their music videos, which is, you know, some of the best stuff they do, obviously, kind of the main thing that they do. But we also get a narrative structure around it as we follow Connor's rise and fall and rise again.
Yeah, it really is the most logical way for them to make a movie, it feels like, because they are able to do the pop culture stuff that they are known for and love to lean on. And I don't mean lean on it in a pejorative way. They get to do songs, performance elements, and they get to move it along quickly, because most documentaries are pretty short, you know? So, yeah, it really, really does make sense for this to be their movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, just by the poster and the way that it was talked about, I think maybe the way I even heard about it the first time is that this was a big Justin Bieber spoof. Mm-hmm. And it's the shortest line you could draw between Connor for Real to anybody is to Bieber, but it's really not just Never Say Never or, you know, the highlights / lowlights of Bieber's career played mm-hmm. out.
Yep. Yeah, because especially with Never Say Never, I believe that's a concert film, right? Which, I mean, this movie has concert film elements, but they're very short. Well, certainly in comparison to most concert films. And yeah, it's not, they really did deal with Bieber less than I expected. It's kind of just the it's really the jumping off point for where Connor is in the present tense, where the story starts out, in that he is an otherworldly superstar that was a prodigious talent as a youth. I mean, they specifically replicated a video of young Justin Bieber playing drums. They make him a baby when it's in Connor's case. Yeah. But like, that's very Bieber-esque. And then they sort of have the fall of the pop star in the way that Bieber experienced it. And
exotic pet.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think appearance wise, he's,
yeah, the steps in his hair is very, very Bieber. But yeah, it's very much the jumping off point, but they get this so much, you know, they make fun of so many different musical acts. Like U2 makes it in there.
Macklemore.
I'm sorry?
Macklemore.
Yeah. Well, of course.
Oh, I love that.
All four Macklemore jokes, and the fact that Pink is the singer in that song makes it so much better. Cause like for so long, her career has been built on, being accepting of everybody, you know, and I just like Pink in general, but like I was just very happy to see her. I was shocked that she was in this movie, but like in such a good way. But they also deal a lot with the Timberlake NSYNC sort of thing, with the one member separating from the rest of the group and being always being the obvious one with the charisma, yeah. And then being more successful than in Connor's case the two, or Timberlake's case the four, other four, sorry. And there's also some Beastie Boys in there, and you know, a little bit of dash of Insane Clown Posse at the end, you know, and
so a deliberate Daft Punk one, but that one's pretty on.
Oh yeah, I didn't even think about that one. It's so
well, they even say Daft Punk, so
do they? Okay, I couldn't remember.
You mean the appliance, you know, like just giving everyone songs.
Yeah, exactly. They ask for them, and the way that the YouTube and Snapchat videos of people talking about it after, it's very very representative of how people felt about the U2 just waking up and having what is it, the Ghost of Joey Ramone or whatever that album was called on their iTunes?
That's,
or was
not
that the single?
Name. That is the single. Innocence of, I don't
Songs
know.
Of Innocence? I don't know. Anyway. Who gives a shit? We're not here for you two.
Right. That's absolutely it. I mean, it's the jumping off point is Bieber, but we get to touch on so many things, and not even just the musical acts. I mean, we get CMZ and all his kind of Snapchat videos. It's so much more about modern celebrity culture than
for sure.
Let's take the dumbest thing Bieber did and blow it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some weird choices of elements of culture that they choose to do. Like Hunter is just Tyler the Creator, which seemed like a weird choice of rapper because not a lot of people know Tyler the Creator, and the highest points of his career came in like 2011, so that was very weird. But yeah, anyway, Chris Redd was amazing in this.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I didn't want to cut you off in case you had more of more on that list, but I thought he was fantastic.
He was so good. Like, I have no idea who that person is. I assume he's a comedian, and I so desperately hope I get to see him in something else, like in 2 days. You know, like no, later tonight. I hope he does like stand up at halftime of the finals tonight. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was fantastic. I mean, he had some good stuff to work with and a kind of a very just wacky character. So that's, you know, fun to run with. But just his look, I mean, his eyes, looking at him, he's just got this look to him that played in so well with the Hunter character. And oh, yeah, he was a pretty big standout for me in a movie that I already was enjoying quite a bit.
Yeah, and his delivery of every line is amazing. Like, the high point of his performance is definitely when he's talking about whether or not he was the person that pranked Connor.
Yeah.
It's so good. Like, oh, man. It's a funny joke because it just keeps going and going and going. But every delivery the delivery of every line is, like, slightly different. And so funny. And it just continues like rolling, and oh god, it's the best.
Yeah. Even his kind of his initial pranks when we're learning what a prankster is to. But yeah, it's the high point is what you described there for
sure. Especially since like most of his pranks are him just being violent towards people. You know, like that's really funny. So.
Yeah. Did you have anything more to say about the kind of celebrity culture angle?
I feel like it'll come up at some point, but I guess it's more about the internet. But there's a obviously a lot of celebrity culture elements in this movie that I feel like we'll be talking about all throughout.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a Matthew Modine joke in it. I like that.
Yep.
Which is a really funny joke because it was pretty true.
I know. It's just, no one ever talks about him. And I mean, it's not as though they should. It's just that every time a joke like that gets through the editing process where they say, are enough people even going to get this?
Yeah. And there are tons of portions of this movie where I'm just like, man, I want to see what got cut. Because you know Sarah Silverman had like 10 other good jokes in that sequence, you know?
Yeah.
Because she didn't even, you know, she doesn't even say those two jokes that she says in one take. So, I'm pretty excited about the eventual Blu-ray for this movie.
Yeah, well, I was even happy Macklemore hadn't. I mean, that song's a few years old now. I didn't know it was still gonna be fair game, but
it's. I mean, it's still just. I mean, it was such a big thing that it's still just memorable. You know, it's not weird in the way the Tyler the Creator jokes are.
Yeah.
In that, you know, Tyler the Creator was never as famous as Macklemore was, but. Yeah, it's just, oh God, it's so good.
Well, and again, it's the same thing about this not just being let's take shots at Justin Bieber. That wasn't a let's take shots at Macklemore. It was just, I mean, a bit of it was. But, it's just this concept of someone being so accepting, having to constantly qualify it, clearly undermines the entire premise of the song.
And, yeah.
It's clearly stated at the end when he admits that song's offensive. And I think he doesn't, extrapolate why, but I think it's exactly what I described there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was part of Lonely Island, kind of just making sure that they had their liberal bleeding heart cred. You know, like that nobody could say that they didn't talk shit about their own stuff, you know?
I think
that was just sort of, that was kind of a safety net for themselves. Like, they didn't need that in the movie because everything is so obvious. Like, if you're a thinking person, you understand what's happening. But, it was, you know, I feel like they probably felt that line was important just for them emotionally.
Okay. Yeah. I'll take it.
Yeah. So what is your favorite song in this movie?
That's the one we were just talking about, the same
equal
love
rights, yeah.
That I did enjoy a lot, and I like Pink too, and having her there doing nothing funny I thought was fantastic too.
Yeah.
You know, not trying to get in on it.
Yeah, she's allowed to give her like her glance at the end, like what's happening, just to show that she doesn't totally agree with what's happening. It's good. It's always way funnier when the celebrity plays it straight in something like that, like the Michael Bolton. Michael Bolton's another good example of that, you know?
Yeah. I really liked Humble. I love hologram jokes, so that had a lot to do with it.
I think my favorite joke in that song is when Andy Samberg says, so expensive. Like, that's just so funny to me. Anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
No, it's a good introduction to, something we'll get to about the larger point of this movie. Mm-hmm. And it came into play with the Macklemore song. And
sorry,
a lot of.
I think you cut out there for a sec.
Oh, the larger point of this movie and a lot of Lonely Island stuff. Mm-hmm. It comes up in that Humble thing. So I think that adds to it too. But I also think it's just hilarious. I guess it's probably the Bin Laden one front to back. I mean, I think that's the reason that's the single. I think the final song's a little bit underwhelming. You know, it's, as you said, the Insane Clown Posse joke. I think it's funny. I think it's not the strongest one, and I understand why it wasn't the big single.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think it works well for the end of the movie.
Yeah, how so?
I think, like, I mean, one of my things about this movie is I think it should have they should have found a way to end on that song. Because I think it builds really well. The Left Shark joke comes out of nowhere and is very funny. And it just sort of, I don't know, it feels like a really good ending when that song ends. Because it's just sort of like, it really encapsulates everything about the movie and allows you to end on what Lonely Island is the best at. I also just wasn't crazy about him being tackled by the wolf at the very end. Like, for me, that... I don't know, like a movie like this, the exclamation mark on the end matters so much to me loving it. Like, this is the end is the perfect example of that. Like, them getting pulled up into heaven during as the Whitney Houston song comes in is so funny. And then they perform Backstreet's Back with the Backstreet Boys. Like, That's just such a good, like, 1-2 punch to close a movie I already really liked, but it just sent, you know, that movie, like, I applauded that movie, which is one of the things I hate the most about the world, you know, is people applauding movies. But it just sort of felt like a movie that should have ended on a musical segment. And there are lots of good jokes in the minute and a half after that song that closes the movie, but I just wish they had found a way to get them in earlier, you know?
Yeah, I think the wolf ending is terrible.
Okay, good.
From what I've heard, no one really likes that. Mm-hmm. It's just way too late and unnecessary. And I wonder if they kind of felt that, as we said, to put together all these musical numbers into a cohesive narrative, they needed to kind of put a button on it, mm-hmm. you know, not end with the performance, even though that's kind of their strong suit, just mm-hmm. to try to get away from that and say, you know, a lot of documentaries don't end with the song, even if it's a, you know, something of a music documentary, mm-hmm. unless it's just a straight up concert film. So that might be the cause of that, but that's just speculation.
Yeah. But going back to the songs, Bin Laden is their finest girl, I guess. Definitely my favorite song, like, because it combines two subgenres of music that I love, or that I just find funny, in that the ultra dirty R&B song mixed with the like overly patriotic song, like idiotically so patriotic, and it was perfect. I think it's the best. I've listened to that song like 10 times, and it still makes me laugh. And the other one that I really love that we haven't talked about yet, partially because it's really minimized in the movie, is Mona Lisa. I think that song is just straight up funny. Like, and you have to listen to it on the soundtrack to even get the best of it. But the first verse really doesn't even lead into what the chorus ends up being, which the chorus is the punchline, is that Mona Lisa is an overrated piece of shit. But the verse leading up to it, like, there's no real hints as to what's happening. You start to figure out that it's going to be about Mona Lisa just as it's getting to the chorus, but it also sets it up in a way that could be like somebody talking about how great the Mona Lisa is. But it's a great song. It's very funny.
Absolutely. And with Finest Girl, and this comes up, you know, multiple times through Lonely Island's musical career, is that they're just talented at making music, mm-hmm. and clearly just listened to a lot of hip hop and mm-hmm. got good at making things that absolutely could have been hits if, I mean, a more, I don't want to say serious, because that doesn't mm-hmm. do it justice, mm-hmm. a less obviously comedic hit. I mean, I think there are moments of music in Finest Girl and Jizz in My Pants that are just could absolutely be club bangers, and they just chose not to use them as that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree.
And that comes from you could tell they actually like hip hop. As much as they like to make fun of hip hop and the most ridiculous things about it, clearly they must be fans to have listened to as much as they do.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite things about The Lonely Island in general, is the way that they treat hip hop. Because I think, I don't remember where Andy Samberg said it, but he said it was always important to them to maintain a respect for what they're making fun of, like where it comes from. And obviously they're all big hip hop fans. It's not hard to tell. And there are lots of good little hip hop jokes in this movie. The Style Boys album cover standing in front of buildings is maybe one of my favorites, which is just so funny. But like, something that I only read recently, I think it was in a Jesse David Fox piece on Vulture that was actually really good. It's about the Lonely Island and their whole career, and it's very worth checking out. But Akiva Schaffer said, I wrote the quote down here. I would challenge anyone to think that any of our songs wouldn't also be funny if black people were singing them. And I think that's like a really cool thing that is clearly, like, now that I know that quote, is clearly something that's been a part of their, I guess, musical value system since day one, because he's right. So few of even their lines rely on race, you know? And I think that's cool, especially because so many comedic rappers build their whole, like Lil Dicky is the example right now, where the whole thing is built around, haha, isn't it funny that a white person is doing this, which is kind of like quietly racist in a sort of backwards way, like how Eminem and, I know we've talked about this, Eminem and the Beastie Boys would get played on rock radio, but other rappers wouldn't. And just by being like, a white person can't be a rapper, so haha, isn't it funny that he's trying, is kind of like quietly also saying that black people can't say star in a movie, you know, like yeah. all this stuff. And I think that's a really cool thing that Lonely Island has done throughout their entire career that doesn't, that they don't get enough credit for.
Yeah. Yeah. And race is entirely absent from this movie.
Yeah, pretty much.
You like, know what the, I mean? There's a
Hunter uses the N-word at one point, and then Andy or Connor explicitly says he's my friend. You know, like, and it's a funny joke, and yeah, yeah. They do touch on race a little bit, but yeah, it's not. It's certainly never like the crux of a joke, other than that one example.
Yeah, and a hard R on.
Yeah, oh man, Tim Meadows saves that because. And this is a sentence I do not say very frequently. Maya Rudolph isn't super funny in that scene. And that Tim Meadows overdub is amazing.
Yeah, but I mean, for a movie that's about, you know, a pop rapper, I guess, but a rapper, and Hunter's a rapper, you know, there are plenty of black and white characters. And as you said, when hip hop comes up, there's often this opportunity to mine humor from that. But they do stay... pretty distant from it most of the time.
Yeah, for
sure. To their credit, because that's kind of the easiest joke to start thinking of, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then they just terrorize that pussy.
I also really like Legalize It, especially its placement in the end credits, because it doesn't really get used in the movie. But I was just sitting through the credits of this movie trying to recover from that runaway train of comedy that I just sat through. And it's just really funny because obviously we've heard a million reggae songs that are about weed, or I guess it feels that way. I don't know that it's actually true, but then the fact that it's about crack is just incredibly funny.
And we get to see Will Arnett drink from an even bigger mug.
I mean, okay, so let's talk about the CMZ scenes now, because they're obviously highlights, especially that first one where Eric Andre and Chelsea Peretti are just losing it. I thought those were all great, but that first one just, it had me rolling.
And I think I liked Eric Andre more than Chelsea Peretti in that one.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Because I'm a big Chelsea Peretti fan.
Yeah, because it's just like this contained insanity, you know, like he's just and Eric Andre is a full-on lunatic, and for him to be going full Eric Andre but also still staying still, I thought it was just really great.
Very good. And Will Arnett.
Oh, Will Arnett's great.
And Mike Birbiglia's odd hair choice.
Yeah. And he wanted to be a longboard model, man.
Yeah, I guess that does make sense.
Yeah. Okay, I don't know. Where do we go from here?
Well, how much of this, I mean, speaking of Lonely Island kind of as a whole, how much of this movie do you feel is about Lonely Island? I mean, you talked about the NSYNC connection of Justin Timberlake being the obvious, most charismatic, best looking one, you know, and then he goes off and has his career. Mm-hmm. And all three of the Lonely Island members, you know, met in junior high, hung out in high school, you know, kind of split up around college, but then just always knew that they were kind of going to go somewhere together and, you know, move to LA or Berkeley and make a career in the entertainment industry together. And their videos start getting seen, and Andy Samberg's the only one who gets to be a featured player on SNL, and the other two just get into the writer's room. And, you know, they continue to make a splash, but Andy Samberg is undeniably the most visibly recognizable one, the most famous one. You know, they all work together still and separately. But I think the comparison's there. How much do you see that in this story?
Yeah, I see it a little bit. I strongly believe that there was never any sort of splintering in the Lonely Island. I think partially because Andy Samberg isn't the type of famous that is like otherworldly, you know, like you're really able to stay grounded when you're Andy Samberg famous, you know? So, and just because I think Andy Samberg is a very realistic person with those things. And I don't know, every time he's being interviewed, he sounds like a legitimately normal person.
Yeah. He barely even plugs his stuff, you know? I mean, it's easy when you find someone funny to try to like them or like what you imagine them to be like in person from your limited exposure. But as you said, it does see all the kind of signs do point to yes on this one.
Yeah, exactly. And like if you're married to Joanna Newsom, you have to be like a thoughtful, smart person, because Joanna Newsom's like lyrics are so thoughtful and interesting, you know? So it's just, I don't know. It's I've never really gotten the feeling that that, you know, there was any sort of splintering a la the Style Boys in this movie, but yeah, it certainly shows, and it even shows their place in culture, kind of, just because Andy Samberg's obviously the forefront and Jorma's second. You know, you've seen Jorma Taccona in a variety of other things. The thing that's coming to mind to me is Girls, but Akiva Schaffer isn't really in things.
Yeah. And even in this movie, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
He's kind of along for the ride.
He's the unseen backbone of the team, you know?
Yeah. And he's the one who would, I mean, even if we could just do Hot Rod again, mm-hmm. Andy's the star. Mm-hmm. Yorma's
the little brother.
Yeah. Probably
he looks like a little brother too.
Yeah. Yeah, true. And then Akiva directs and mm-hmm. you know, that's it. And yeah, it maps really well along this story. I would agree with you. Either they haven't splintered, or if they did, they did it very quietly and are doing a great job of hiding it.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think your assessment's right. It's just, I mean, I guess right what you know, but there is, you know, a kind of a one-to-one ratio here with a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of it is just sort of comparing a version of how their lives collectively have gone with how other examples of the same thing have gone, and just sort of tying the two together in a way that makes the movie better, you know, even if it's not necessarily 100% representative of what has happened within their friendship.
Did you know it was still Akiva when he put that wooden mask over his face?
I actually didn't. I lost him for a second. So many jokes in this movie. There are like a million jokes in this movie, because there are jokes covered up by jokes that are covered up by jokes. You know, like there's a song going through that's got a joke. There's somebody telling a joke in audio while all these Twitter handles are flying at you, all of which are jokes. Like it's incredible. It's really amazing.
Right. And I think,
like, laugh a minute is a phrase that is said about comedies that does not do this movie justice.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder how much of that comes with kind of internet culture. I mean, if you're making movies in the 70s or in the 50s even, you know, it's just not as fast paced. You're mm-hmm. not plugging this many jokes in. And I think, you know, I love some movies from the 50s and 60s where the comedy is basically every line is, you know, very well structured and sets mm-hmm. up another joke and another joke. And, you know, there's just these really good bits of dialogue that are consistently funny. But as you said, this isn't even just every line's a joke. There's also visually these things coming at you that you need to take in with the dialogue, you know, and the song and, you know, some of these bigger things that are references to things that happened in real life and spoofing them in that way. So mm-hmm. How much of that do you think comes from that, and how much of their style altogether do you think is tied in with the internet?
I mean, I think they have kind of helped to create the internet style of joke telling. I think they've had a big influence. I think Tim and Eric's Old Spice commercials have had a big influence, just in that these are two prominent examples of things that such a high number of people saw. Lonely Island Digital Shorts, just because they would go quote unquote viral, and the Old Spice commercials because they were popular and also everybody saw them because they were shown during so many different like sporting events and stuff, and they were just so weird and so also fast paced, and I think that has really helped to sort of accelerate this sort of, I suppose, Snapchat culture, where there's time for a very quick joke and nothing else, and also people kind of want that joke quicker, you know. And it's the acceleration of culture that Lonely Island is. I mean, this is, I think, the most negative thing I will say about Lonely Island. Every great thing brings something terrible with it, and that's the thing I don't like about the Lonely Island, is that their pacing, despite making their work better, often I think has helped the acceleration of internet culture in some level. You know, it's totally unquantifiable, but it's just a feeling that I have that I think is right, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I know there's a couple of, I don't know, web series, you know, breaking down, you know, cinema, and, you know, you like that. It breaks down the cinematography or certain elements of the story. And the ones that I've noticed you like are the ones that take their time versus some of the YouTube ones where they just speak as quickly as you could understand them.
Oh, and that drives me bananas.
Oh, I know it does. That's what I'm saying. And I think, you know, it's not a straight line from Hot Rod to that, but it's all being part of kind of the same thing of just trying to jam more in at the same, you know, as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not saying it's like a blanket bad thing, like, because I think I'm pretty sure we've talked about this, where I think, you know, rules are definitely important in comedy, and I think a good comparison point for that is the sitcom, where the sitcom is at now, where you've got sitcoms on Netflix that can be anywhere between 25 to 32 minutes long per episode, say, like Four Seasons of Arrested Development, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, all these other things, where they just don't move as fast as what you're used to sitcoms doing. And that doesn't necessarily hurt the show if you're doing it right. But say something like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, having that like 21-minute capper, I think often makes that show better, because they're partially, it's the 3-minute rule with the Lonely Island. Like, they're cutting out their version of verses and making it tighter and making it stronger. I guess the best example of this is Community season 1 and 2 are so good. And then the last season of Community, which is good, but the pace is totally gone, and it's because they were on Yahoo and they could take their time with everything, which is something that somebody, a writer, say like Dan Harmon, that is really precious with all their jokes, has always wanted to do. He would probably thought, man, wouldn't it be great if we could make 30-minute episodes back in 2009 when we were doing season 1. And it hurt the show. You know, it was a good season of television, but it wasn't as good as it could have been, just because the rule wasn't there. And so it's like, it's this weird line that you have to balance, because obviously that's not a hard rule for any show. But like I don't know, you just have to know what rules you need to follow for the best of your own, for the best comedy that you can make, and which rules to ignore. So I don't know, that's rambly, but I think points in there apply.
Yeah, no, and I think they were doing so well on the internet and kind of at a point given free rein on SNL, kind of shown very clearly in Laser Cats, where Lorne Michaels doesn't seem to like the visual quality of it, doesn't think or know why it's funny.
But I mean, I don't like those sketches.
Laser Cats?
Yeah, I don't like them.
Yeah, they've got animals in them. I just mean, it seemed like at a point they were kind of given free rein, where they would just make it instead of pitching it, and it would get shown a lot of the time. Yet they were still keeping them to under 3 minutes and keeping them short. Mm-hmm. You know, just kind of something built into them that understands what the limit is. Even though on the internet you could make it as long as you wanted, they kind of opt away from that. And even on their albums, they don't make really long sketches or anything.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's just funny thinking about them and how, you know, looking at them as one of the early viral videos and or viral video successes, and thinking about, you know, the internet is this place for things that couldn't make it on TV or would be too weird to be put on TV, or a big corporation would never get behind it, and then think that these were being played on NBC on television, you know, and I understand 12:50 in the morning on a Sunday morning is not the same thing as primetime CBS, but it is interesting.
I love the idea of the Lonely Island airing at 8:30 p.m. on a Monday on CBS
with a Chuck Lorre title card.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, vanity card. That was the best choice of network for you.
Great. Oh, deliberate.
Great joke. but yeah, I agree with what you're saying. One of my favorite things about the movie, it's in the Turn Up the Beef song. Phrase. I didn't know Emma Stone could make me like her more than I already do, but I think she gained like slightly more respect for me. Yeah. Even though I thought we were at 100 out of 100. But the catchphrase verse, I think I love the catchphrase verse because it simultaneously is funny, makes fun of the Lonely Island's fans that they probably don't care for, and also sort of helps to talk about the thing that they have helped create, where you know, where we talked about Snapchat and Vines and stuff like that, that only have time for a catchphrase, basically. The I'm on a boat, you know, like you don't get the whole song. You just get I'm on a boat, you know. And I thought that was a really cool thing to do, because I like any time a very popular, I guess, in this example, collective is able to make fun of their own fans in a funny way that a lot of them, it probably goes over their head, you know? And I really like that. I think that's really funny to me, you know, because it's like quietly mischievous in a way that the Lonely Island really isn't, because they just seem like, they all seem like such nice people. But it's, that's the meanest thing they would do, you know?
Yeah. And it also kind of goes in for, Connor Farrell's character of having absolutely no substance.
Exactly.
Throwing catchphrases on there.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I love the catchphrase verse.
Yeah, no, it's great. And it's great that it's such a big pivot point for the movie as well.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and it's still funny. Like one of us will probably text the phrase dinky nuts to the other over the next six days or something, you know? But the fact that it also is kind of quietly ripping on its fans is cool, because like, I mean, I can't watch I'm on a Boat now. I mean, I don't think I ever watched it since it aired, just because it so quickly became a thing that annoyed me, even though I remember thinking it was funny. Jizz in My Pants is another good example. Dick in a Box for sure.
They all went somewhere Space Olympics never did.
Yeah, exactly. Like and that's not to say that I was upset that the Lonely Island made songs that were unbelievably popular, that I can't see that how that's a bad thing for me in the long term, specifically because I think those songs allow for Popstar to exist, a movie I'm very happy exists. But I don't know, it just sort of, it took some of the fun out of the song when I'm just at a party and somebody throws on I'm on a Boat and people just keep yelling, I'm on a boat. I don't know. There's just something about it that was annoying to me. And I don't know. It's just fun to see that made fun of, because I like it when people make fun of idiots without the idiots knowing. And I think there's a lot of that in The Lonely Island.
Yeah, well, with kind of what I was saying about the Connor, the catchphrase verse, and kind of the bigger message of, I don't know if message, but theme of this movie and a lot of Lonely Island stuff, Hot Rod and, you know, selections of their digital shorts, is about kind of earning your success. And I know that's obviously a theme of every movie, is, you know, failing at first, getting a little better, then succeeding. That's, I've just described every movie ever made except the Jerry or whatever. but that does seem to be really prevalent with their work. And I think the catchphrase thing is a big part of it. I mean, a catchphrase is supposed to be this one thing that, you know, is the cherry on top of a character, and to not even build that character in this situation, you know, to have no substance and just kind of the stylish flair, I think speaks to a lot of what they do. Do you find that throughout Popstar and Lonely Island altogether?
I think so. Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't really have anything to add. I just agree.
Yeah. Well, no, I just mean, I know that's, it's kind of so broad, but all of Connor Farrell's character, you know, he rejects everything that made his first solo album successful. All the music being produced by someone who actually knew what they were doing. You know, not appreciating his manager, people around him, surrounding himself with yes men, things like that. Mm-hmm. And Hot Rod as well. I mean, one of the big turning points for that movie is when he plays his movie in front of everybody and they start laughing. And, you know, he's edited that little movie together as well as he could have without having any talent for being a daredevil. You know what I mean? It's kind of just packaging something without kind of creating that something in the first place, which... It seems so interesting for me because these guys are so emblematic of the internet generation, and that seems to be the opposite of the way the internet functions, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think you see that a lot in Popstar with the way that the internet is portrayed, like, and all throughout, because, like,
you jacked it.
You were not mellow enough.
Yeah, that's true.
Your line reading was not mellow enough. But oh, and what he's brushing his teeth, how it says video 4 of 60 or part 4 of 16. Yeah, so yeah. Funny. But like, yeah, you're right in that he really does, after the success of Thriller, also shun had to get that in there, shun all of the people that are close to him. And he seems to really want to reach out to all of the people that he barely knows, which is part of what he does with quote unquote connecting with his fans, which seems to be a big part of his life early on in the movie. And the movie, throughout the movie, he's slowly has to learn that that the internet is sort of a cacophony of emptiness, you know, like, and that the only people that really like, and the catchphrase verse is also emblematic of that, because you know, he's by posting this YouTube video of him brushing his teeth or whatever, he's sending it out to people that will only listen to, say, 3 words out of 10 that he says, you know. And that's why he eventually realizes he should hang on to his friends, because they're the people that will listen to 10 out of 10 words, you know. Yeah. Just because there's more of a bond, there's more appreciation for each other, there's more love there. And yeah, that's also a theme that we've seen done a million times, but that this movie is so not pointedly, but it's very much about the internet and the fact that the internet can create great things, but the internet is also kind of a terrible place to care about a lot. And and I like that ending of the movie as well. Yeah,
no, I do too. And I think it's you just, as this group has so much to thank the internet for, mm-hmm. you know, I imagine they see a lot of the downsides of it as well, being more engaged with it and having more riding on it. And yeah, I think you're right. That is not really done in a overly ham-fisted way in this movie. But I think it's kind of weaved in and out throughout almost all of it. I mean, mm-hmm. we get those Vines and Snapchats and stuff very early on. Mm-hmm. And we do have a...
And they're all throughout the movie, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, we do get a female character so engrossed in her smartphone that she's literally eating dog shit, and it's not registering with her. And I think that's a pretty clear visual metaphor for what we've been describing.
Yeah, for sure. And the another thing that ties into that is the Ashley Wednesday relationship as well.
Which is,
Imogen Poots has very little to do in this movie, but her one bit where she's talking about looking at relationships when she's a kid and seeing like which ones are fake and which ones are real, and just saying she wants to be one of them, like that whole bit is wonderful. You know, and very, very funny. Yeah.
And she kind of does it in a pretty meandering way that you're kind of hooked in. She's speaking really slowly and pensively, but it's very good.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the, there aren't a ton of jokes in this movie that take their time to build, and that's really one of them, you know, like that, because that's more of a, that's much more of an old school, I mean, not even old school, just sort of like not Lonely Island style of comedy. Not that the Lonely Island is incapable of writing such things, because obviously they can, they wrote that, but it's just great to see parts like that interspersed throughout the movie. I think the Hammerleg selling out the 18,000 seat theater, that's another really good example of that. We talked about the 30 seconds to Mars joke.
A lot of those, but especially that Ashley Wednesday stuff.
Yeah,
that,
for sure.
That seems so Christopher Guest mockumentary, you know. Mm-hmm. Someone who is so who seems so real, and you kind of, you know, they kind of lead you down the primrose path, you know, you think you know where they're going with this, and then they quietly turn it around. And yes, that was very good.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, there's so much good stuff in this movie. Like I said, there are probably a million jokes in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Got anything else? Martin Sheen, Attica?
Oh, so good. I mean, it's just, at this point, we'd just be listing jokes that we love.
I know.
One other thing that I liked, this is something that is very quick in the movie and ended up being like perfect timing on their part, just because of how many surprise releases that have been very obviously telegraphed have come out like this spring, like Rihanna's and Beyonce's, Radiohead's. When Connor says he's dropping his new single, or surprise releasing his new single next Thursday at noon, like I just thought that was in one line really indicative of pop or popular music now, and that it's like, yeah, we've got to drop these things quickly without any sort of build up, but also we still need to build it up a little bit now. You know, like where a surprise releases used to actually just be, okay, here it is now. Now it's like there is this quiet, more viral inspired sort of rumbling leading to the release. Like, but everybody that knew anything about pop music knew that, you know, Beyonce's Lemonade was whatever Lemonade was premiering Saturday night at 10 on HBO. And you knew that there was going to be an album, you know, like there's just no way that she just decided to make a 1 hour one off talk show, you know, like that wasn't going to be what it was, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, and I just thought that was a really, really good joke. And, especially timely, given that it must have been filmed last summer, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So good on you, Lonely Island.
On the cutting edge.
Yep. So yeah, I hope they get to make another movie. So yeah, thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men, and be sure to check back next week.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.